it was a good decision. I must confess, we went in with some trepidation because this was a very comprehensive and well sort of documented proposal to harmonize the entire city with a glyphosate and fatty acid mix. We wondered how we were going to overcome this, but as it happened, this decision had already been taken and had already been worked out by the councillors. So we had a situation where the chairman, Richard Hills, had obviously done an awful lot of homework and an awful lot of lobbying. And he basically put forward an amendment or amendments to the proposal, such that the proposal, which was based on harmonizing the city with this methodology of a glyphosate fatty acid mix, instead went with a harmonizing or standardizing the budget, so that it was a question then that the budget was available to all the local boards, and therefore their ability to choose a non-chemical option was available to them. So this was really good, and it was a unanimous decision. This was a really important point, which again was brought forward, and Deputy Chairman Pippa Coombe and Richard again between them. The weed management policy, which this proposal to harmonise was supposed to be the implementation of the weed management policy, was not that, because the weed management policy has a priority for non-chemical methodologies. So to prioritise with chemicals meant that you were actually going against the adopted policy. Therefore, the proposal to move away from this and to have as a priority non-chemical, particularly thermal technologies, meant that we were finally back on track. And this was absolutely vital that we had this implementation, bringing us all back to the basics that had been adopted 7 years ago, that priority was given to non-chemical. So that was a good decision. We also had a side decision that was made that there was Māori representation, that they hadn't been properly consulted, that they'd been left out of the process. And again, there was strong representation and strong recommendations that the council would be going back to Māori, who had expressed a strong recommendation that they did not want chemicals on the streets and the roads. And so they've now got to go back to Māori. And again, this is a marvellous opportunity to hear from the people and to look at solutions which are available.
When we're talking about a harmonising of budget, that doesn't necessarily mean an increase so other areas or other localities have more budget. Is it simply a reorganisation of existing money?
The feeling is quite strongly, because one of the things that came as a bit of a shock, that finally it was outed at a council meeting that it was possible to do thermal technology for less than $1,000 a kilometre. So every local board has a different number of kilometres that need to be covered within their locality. So if you harmonise the budget by saying council's budget was, well, they had changed it during, you know, the intervening year of two meetings, but they had fixed a budget of this sum of money, which I think was $1,050 a kilometre, to do glyphosate and fatty acid mix. So one local board area might have 900 kilometres and another local board might have 2,000 kilometres. So they would be given the budget to cover the number of kilometres that they have. But during the meeting, it was revealed by Councillor Wayne Walker that one of the thermal companies was able to do every kilometre for, I think it was $890 a kilometre, which was less money than what council were allocating for the glyphosate fatty acid mix. So it was immediately obvious that you had a situation where the entire city could be treated with thermal technology for less money than the budget was available.
Am I correct in now saying that it's up to each local board to decide whether they want to spend that money on thermal technology versus chemical technologies?
This is a really interesting question. There is really strong interest in some of the local boards for that. The suggestion was is that some of these local boards could in fact band together, and by banding together and going to the facilities contractor, they can in fact get a reduced and even further reduced cost, because there is, you know, possibilities of scale, reduction in costs by greater scale. So this is not simple. There are problems arising about how current contracts with the community facility operators could be altered or changed, or allow this change of methodology and costing, which is still to be worked out. So we're into that next phase where the local boards can have this information and actually work on this. And hopefully, as I say, they'll be able to form larger consortiums so that the prices will come down even further.
What do we think the likelihood of local boards not adopting thermal or alternative technologies is?
And this is, I think, again, where the councillors and the local board chairs and members are working together, because the information that they'd received was they were asked to make decisions on budget based on incorrect information. They did not have this information. They were not given an option of having a thermal technology for a low price. They were basically told it's too expensive, the carbon emissions are too great, too much water is used. Therefore, it wasn't even laid before the local boards that they could have this option. So now it's a question of all the local boards being given this information, and it's not so much for us to go out to the local boards and tell them. It's because the local boards, and particularly the North Shore local boards, who have had thermal technology for the last 20 years, and they're the ones who are driving this, we're hoping, will be able to go to the other local boards and tell them of their experience and go from there. So I think there would be very few local boards who would resist this, because this is what residents and the people have been asking for decades. Non-chemical.
Do you think the numbers and emissions numbers as well will sit in the back of anyone's mind when making the decision, regardless of the accuracy of the initial numbers?
Yes, I think, and I think it is a valid question that needs to be asked, but which is back down to what I hope it's in our previous conversation we talked about the fact that, you know, it's not just switch from spraying glyphosate to using a steam or a hot water or foam spray. We're talking about a whole different paradigm shift. And so all of the other things which can offset it, like, you know, we shouldn't be mowing the berms, we shouldn't be having to use hot water, glyphosate, anything else. There's a whole lot of, if you've got a situation where it's non-chemical, people can adopt their berms, they can start growing vegetables, they can have flower gardens, we can actually be putting carbon, you know, we could be sequestering it and not actually having to treat it. So that's the exciting way forward, that it's not a dead end, that it's the beginning of a whole new way of doing things.
Before we get further in depth with those further solutions, you mentioned that this is the start of perhaps a paradigm shift. What else needs to come alongside the adoption of these new methodologies? What you mentioned thinking about sequestering carbon. We've just announced a national climate emergency, and alongside the government's work with that, this all comes together in the shift of paradigms. And what attitudes need to be changed? What human methods? What do we need to change that we already do in order to make the most of perhaps implementing a more sustainable vegetation management plan or more sustainable practices in other areas of our climate crisis response?
I strongly support Hannah's concept of this paradigm change in this space. And for me, it's not just climate change issues in here. We need to look at the whole spectrum of environmental challenges that we face, you know, so soil degradation, you know, nutrients in the environment, climate change, microplastics, you know, general pollution, you know, so all those different factors, and also all the social factors in there as well. So it may seem like it's weed management, but sitting behind it, there's an awful lot of things that need to be brought into the conversation, as they do, I would suggest, for all activities that are the likes of councils and governments and individuals are taking. We need to be cognizant of these issues and making decisions based on the situation we find ourselves in this planet at the moment. And then it does drill down, as Hannah says, a lot of the time, as I've said many times before, New Zealand has a fetish for weed management and controlling vegetation. And there's activities in New Zealand that would get you locked up in Europe. You know, you would be in jail for doing what we do here if you did that in Europe. So, you know, Hannah's example, just stop mowing the grass. You know, we've got a whole load of stuff that doesn't need to be sprayed at the moment, that doesn't need to be controlled by any method. And in fact, we need to take a quite different approach, and that's get more vegetation growing. So to me, that's kind of the first step. And for me, any form of weed management, whether it's physical or chemical or biological, whatever, really should be the last option. Yes. We should be letting the plants be and doing their job of sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And only when they're causing real and actual harm should we be taking any action against them. And then the least amount of action that's required to mitigate that real and actual harm.
You mentioned there the social factors behind this discussion of weed management. And how would you describe the parallels between addressing the social factors and addressing the problem of weed management?
One of the really interesting, this whole social thing is this desire so many people have for wanting to have this manicured, clipped, aesthetically clean berms. There was a delightful story out of, I think it was Otago or Christchurch, of some poor guy having Otago. A note slipped into his letterbox about the fact that he wasn't cutting his grass often enough and it was untidy. Now, that having a shift to say, look, you know, if you want to have this immaculate, it means that you have to have machines out here, you know, every week, every other week. We need to somehow or other allow ourselves to be educated. Hey, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a wildflower meadow, you know? But people have got to, we have to sort of say, this is really important. It's all these little steps. How many millions of little plots outside people's houses are there? And if everybody, in adopting their berm, didn't have to have it treated in any way, that would be fantastic. But we do have to somehow or other away from this idea that we've got to have this wonderfully manicured roadsides.
So I guess I would just add that we're talking about two separate areas when we're talking about street weed control management. There is the part of that space that holds the road, and that's the priority for Auckland Transport and for council, is to make sure that the infrastructure is not damaged by rogue plant life. But then there's the space that sits alongside that actually is a massive opportunity alongside all the other opportunities to actually learn together how to get the maximum amount of biomass to be growing in that space to meet the other obligations, which include climate change mitigation, which include biodiversity well-being, which also include our stormwater, our runoff issues. One of the really significant things that happens in the street space is that when there is a heavy water event, there is a lot of water that travels down that space that doesn't need to if it's actually captured and held by the biomass alongside it. So I think there's a real opportunity for councils and government and, in fact, individuals to start thinking much more complexly. It's no longer in the situation we find ourselves in with climate change. It's no longer sufficient for us to deal with one issue at a time. We actually now need to look at our economic spend and make sure that the economic spend is actually managing multiple KPIs. And what's really exciting is that when you start to move into the organic regenerative systems thinking, you start to actually meet many of those KPIs at one time. So what you're talking about, Hannah, with revisiting how we plant our berms. I think I'm actually in the car at the moment and driving down the motorway. There are significant parts of the motorway edge that actually has planting on it. And then there are parts that actually have a huge amount of weed. And the weed is there present because actually the soil's been degraded over the last, 25 years with so much glyphosate in it that weeds are really the only things in those spaces now that will grow. So I think what's exciting about the thermal technologies, and particularly if we start to have smaller companies take on contracts that are more locally orientated, that will give those people who are managing those contracts a chance to hopefully think a lot more complexly where they want to be thinking in that way, and actually to be able to be present to the seasonal changes that influences the way plants grow, and to be able to respond more quickly and effectively and cost effectively with the part of that edge that then threatens the infrastructure, which is the road.
We mentioned opportunities there, both Sarah and Hannah. What are these opportunities that we can take on right now?
So I think the very first opportunity is to be really starting to look at the new thermal control innovations that have been present but are also being refined. So we actually have hot water, we have foam, and then we have saturated steam. And they actually all use heat and water, but they have slight differences as well. So I think there are a number of companies who've been really trying to, get some traction in New Zealand and haven't been able to due to the nature of the decision making that's been happening in the past. So I think one of the first opportunities is that we really hope to see these thermal processes, be able to move ahead in leaps and bounds due to a lot more interest in them and therefore some more investment in and actually progressing those technologies.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's, I was thinking in terms of opportunities, things like improving soil health and biodiversity. But yeah, the opportunities there in terms of the machinery as well. these thermal techniques have been used, for many, many, many years. So they're hardly new in terms of concept. But then in terms of, having the suppliers, the contractors providing these services and their ability to therefore have ongoing business and therefore being able to spend money to improve their systems and refine them. To me, until something like a council, and certainly a council the size of Auckland, makes the decision they're going to be serious about trying alternatives, there's just such a major disincentive for people to get into this space. So to me, that's the opportunity here, is the council saying, we're going to get serious, we're going to do this, and give the businesses and the companies the opportunity to prove and show and demonstrate what they can do.
You mentioned some opportunities there that would probably result from the adoption of alternative methods. Did you want to go into those in a bit more depth?
Okay, let's start at the bottom. Soil and healthy soils are what civilization is based on, because healthy soil is what our food is grown in. We need to, virtually 99% of humanity's food is still grown in the soil. So if we destroy soil, we destroy ourselves. Franklin Roosevelt said that. So looking after soil should be one of the major activities humans undertake. Soil is also core in virtually all the biogeochemical cycles globally. So, carbon, there's far more carbon in the soil than there is in the atmosphere above our heads. So soil is critical in all aspects of the environmental problems we face. So that's why we need healthy soil. To make a healthy soil, or soil healthy, is actually relatively straightforward. You need living plants growing in it, and ideally nice big living plants, best trees, but at least, you know, some nice long pasture, i.e. grass, and a diversity of species. So at the moment, you know, we're talking about these berms, they're being mown on a repeated basis. The soil underneath them isn't anywhere near as healthy as it could be by letting that grass grow, and introducing more diverse species into that environment. And then, you know, particularly if you put flowering plants in there as well, then you can start having benefit for pollinators. So right back to the, you know, the whole point of for the love of bees. So to me, it's the paradigm shift Hannah's talking about. We need to just stop thinking about these things as lawn. We need to think about them as really vital parts of our lived environment. And as Sarah said, you know, at the moment we get a heavy heavy rain downpour, these current mown berms, these mown areas, the soil can't absorb the water very fast, it's highly compacted, and various other, you know, negative effects on it. So the water just runs off it, almost like it's running off tarmac. By allowing the vegetation and the pasture to get much longer, that will actually hold on to the water can soak it well.
Yeah, there's another, you know, in addition to soil, you know, we're talking about trees. And when I drive around Auckland, I see massive expanses of grass, and we're talking about letting the grass grow, and we're talking about trees. But the trees that they plant along the side of the roads now tend to be tea trees. They tend to be smaller shrub-like trees. So, you know, for me, say, you know, a puriri is like the oak of New Zealand. It's a grand old lady. It feeds the nectar birds at the same time it feeds the seed-eating birds. And when they're sort of allowed to grow, not in a forest, they are massive like an oak. If they're in a forest, they grow up narrowly. So the idea of, like, you know, creating, you know, safety berms along the sides of roads, but then actually just allow, you know, growing up these massive, I don't know what is, you know, whether it's kahikatea, pukatea, puriri, or, you know, what miro, whatever's up, you know, in Auckland, but creating rainforest throughout New Zealand, you know, up throughout Auckland, and you know, allowing these trees to not just be in small neat patches or clumps, but seeing them all along the side of roads can help sort of change that. And of course, you have the, you know, with the rainforest and the forestry systems, the leaves are there, you know, becoming the soil web that then feeds the trees, and you can contain that so that the leaves aren't making everything messy and freaking out the neat freaks. But it can work beautifully and become a very distinctive and attractive habitat that becomes, you know, in the long term, a very significant tourist attraction as well.
And if I'm not mistaken as well, it's hugely beneficial for bird life as well, creating those, among other fauna, creating those patches in urban environments. Someone, I think, mentioned sequestering carbon and carbon emissions before, or maybe I was just imagining it. But by introducing these urban forests or urban nahiri, and diversifying what is growing in our berms by not spraying glyphosates on them, what can we do towards the carbon emission conversation?
Well, that would simply increase the amount of carbon being fixed and therefore held in the soil biomass and also in the living biomass. You know, a tree is a great pillar of carbon.
So are there figures around what the carbon positive opportunity is for?
There are. It's one of these ghastly scientific areas. You'd think it'd be relatively easy to measure this stuff, that, you know, particularly soil carbon. Soil carbon's ghastly because of a simple issue of changing from percentage measurements to absolute measurements. It's quite bonkers, but it's a massive problem. But there's some ballpark figures, and particularly, you know, in the debate, you know, around the billion trees kind of things, the relative merits of fast growing conifers versus native vegetation and various other things. When you start throwing in that wider conversation that everybody's been touching on, it's not just the carbon we need to think about. It is the biodiversity. It's the insects. It's the soil microbe biodiversity. It's our insect biodiversity. It's our native bird biodiversity. It's, you know, native plants as well. So, you know, all these factors need to come in.
So going back to the carbon positive impacts of soil, what is there a range of perceptions of that? Could you argue that the scientists are arguing about a range?
Okay. So there's no doubt that if you allow the vegetation to diversify, increase in complexity and size, you will build carbon, full stop. No disagreement there. The arguments are how much and how quickly.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing we need to be really mindful of is heat. So our streetscapes going forward are getting hotter. And where there is a road, there is often tarmac, concrete, and those materials absorb heat and make them really, and as the temperatures increase, become untenable for human beings to be in those spaces. As soon as you put significant biomass, trees, into those very same spaces, you very effectively cool that temperature. And in Japan, where in Kyoto, they did some tests a number of years ago on inner city streets where they had invested in significant tree cover in those streets, highly, CBD kind of context. There was a differential between the shade and the area of the street with no shade. So that's also another really significant, contribution that biomass can make.
Indeed, the urban heat island effect, I believe, for us urban design nerds, it may be called. Drawing this all back to local boards and the decision that is at hand, we've just talked about a whole heap of stuff and a whole heap of solutions and a whole heap of opportunities. And I'm going to do a very poor job in summarizing what we've just said, but it sounds like instead of imagining our berms and other urban green areas which are controlled by glyphosates, controlling them with chemicals, instead of controlling them with chemicals and treating them as something to be purely for aesthetics, by shifting to thinking about them as living spaces, we have a whole heap of new things and new opportunities and new life, which have a whole heap of solutions to a whole heap of problems that we seem to be facing in the way that we've approached our approach to the climate crisis. So the decision and opportunity now for local boards and those deciding to go ahead is much more than deciding whether we're using glyphosates. Is that somewhat correct?
Yeah, exactly. You kind of just think this is an issue about vegetation management. It's not. It's actually about all the global challenges we face, both environmental and the social side of stuff as well. The tidy freaks. New Zealand has a lot of tidy freaks, and a large part of this issue, I think, is we need to change hearts and minds. And I think there's a particular role here for elected representatives, at local and national government, to actually try and start engaging this conversation, to start saying, we don't need to, have our environment looking this manicured and this, this controlled. There's a need for, activists and civil society and stuff to be involved here in promoting it. But, there's an issue. We need to change that attitude. And certainly we've seen it, going back down to Dunedin again, they changed the contract there. The new contractor hasn't been on top of stuff. There's weeds growing in places that people don't like, and it's headline news, and through letterboxes and stuff.
So the terminology, I think, that's been used overseas that I think has huge agency with it is the term rewilding. Mm. And that is what we need to be doing. We need to be doing it at all scales. We need to be, obviously we don't want to be doing monoculture forestry. We want to be doing, much more diverse forestry. But when it comes to the streetscape, we also need to be thinking about rewilding. And that's where the most mitigation comes, is when you actually have a rewilded environment. So you've got diversity of species, you've got complexity of species, you've got density of species. And I think it's the density of species that's really going to make a difference in the weed management area, because weeds tend to be, so weeds are really plants that nobody wants to be in a place. A plant needs to be there. What that plant is something that we actually, as managers of the vegetation, get to have some influence over if we manage that process well. So I think one of the exciting things that we know has been happening in Australia, where they've been using the thermal control for quite some time, and I think, you know, that's one of the things that Hannah's mentioned, is that these contractors need to actually have a significant amount of time to be able to prove the benefit of this new strategy. And one of the things that they managed to do in Australia is that, yes, they are controlling the weed or the plant that nobody wants to be there in the crack of the road, or, you know, on the edge of the road, but they're also they're introducing like seeds of plants that people don't see as weeds into that space as they're using the thermal. And one of the things that people probably don't quite understand is that the thermal technology, what it does is it's kind of like it steams the vegetation, and what it leaves is a lovely, pulpy, moist environment where a seed of a plant that you would love to grow there actually has a head start. It's the perfect context for a plant to actually be able to grow. So that's the kind of paradigm thinking that we need to be embracing, is that as we're getting rid of a plant that we don't want, we're actually at the very same moment introducing a plant that we would love to be there, because the soil wants to be repaired, and the soil can only be repaired with the plant. So it's about actually being forward thinking with what are the plants that we want in this environment. You know, we don't always want trees in an environment where we actually need to have visibility for safety, but we can be introducing low-growing complex plants in those environments, as well as introducing the bigger plants in areas where visibility isn't so much of a concern.